Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer. SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting.
Than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience.
With Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You've heard of the Department of Education, and lately, you've probably been hearing about it a lot. The Trump administration has announced plans to dismantle it. And for many, the move feels shocking, even unprecedented.
On March 20th, President Trump signed this executive order, which is aimed at closing the U.S. Department of Education and giving authority to the states.
But in reality, it's just the latest chapter in a long-running battle over who controls education in America, a battle that stretches all the way back to the Civil War and intersects with nearly every turning point in U.S. history, from world wars to the space race to one of the country's most infamous cults. This week, we're digging into that history, tracing the federal government's evolving role in education and how the Department of Education ultimately became a cornerstone of American life. I'm Margot Gray. This week on Campus Files, Breaking Deadlock.
There's never been a time in all American history or colonial history that there wasn't intense national attention on what schools were doing.
That's Adam Lotz, a historian and leading expert on American education. He knows better than most. In the U.S., education has always been a political battleground. For generations, parents and policymakers have clashed over how we shape the minds of future citizens. It's a fight that's been raging since the end of the Civil War.
The Department of Education was established after the war, and it didn't do much. It was only going to have 4 employees, you know, a tiny budget, and it mostly was symbolic.
Tiny budget, tiny staff, but the controversy was massive.
The status of education in the federal government was always a hot button.
Former Confederate states were deeply opposed to the idea of a Department of Education for reasons that probably sound familiar today. They saw it as federal overreach and feared it would impose a Northern or Yankee perspective on their schools.
Former Confederates at this point strongly object to any federal role in education, and they first just cut the budget. They engage in sort of personal attack on its first secretary.
In reality, the department did little more than collect data. But the mere possibility that it might one day wield real power was enough to ignite a political firestorm. And just 2 years after its creation, the department was disbanded. What followed was a kind of stalemate, a decades-long deadlock between 2 competing visions for American education. On one side were the reformers, who believed the federal government had a responsibility to ensure every child had access to a high-quality education. On the other side were the individualists, who wanted schools left to states and families, free from federal interference. For nearly a century, the individualists had the upper hand. The federal government kept its distance, and reformers struggled to gain political traction. But then, in October 1957, at the height of the Cold War, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first man-made satellite to orbit the Earth. For 22 days, it circled the globe, broadcasting a steady radio signal that even amateur radio operators could pick up from their backyards.
A real shock to see and to hear radio was playing this pinging sound, which if you understood that these were the sounds of a Russian satellite, the first satellite circling the Earth, it struck Americans as frightening that the Soviet Union had been able to seize this scientific initiative.
Nearly 50 years later, it's hard to fathom just how terrifying that moment was for Americans. The Soviet Union was soaring directly over U.S. cities and military bases. And perhaps most unsettling of all, they'd vaulted ahead of the United States in science and technology.
Scientifically, militarily, politically, these tracking antenna, by the knowledge they will gather from the speeding orb, may well affect mankind as nothing before.
The Soviets were also outpacing the U.S. in science education, training 2 to 3 times as many scientists each year. Sputnik was a wake-up call. America's education system, especially in science and math, was falling dangerously behind.
Sputnik is a product of higher education, of instructors who teach much of the physics and mathematics in high school that we teach in college. Our survival may depend on degrees and graduates we are not now equipped to produce.
In the 1950s, it was still illegal to teach evolutionary science in states like Tennessee and Arkansas. From a federal and defense perspective, the idea that huge swaths of the American populace, children, were not being exposed to basic scientific content. So if you're a military leader, that's not just a shame, that's frightening.
Almost overnight, the reformers had a much stronger case to make. If the federal government stayed out of education, the U.S. could lose its military and technological edge. Less than a year later, Congress approved hundreds of millions of dollars to strengthen and standardize science education across the country, despite fierce pushback from the individualists.
It's hugely controversial. You have local leaders who infamously call in teachers on Christmas break to razor out sections on human reproduction and also to just like black out book by book, page by page, sections that they found offensive. Not because they weren't true, not because they weren't important, but because they involved evolution or human reproduction.
But still, the deadlock had been broken, and reformers moved quickly.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. We choose to go to the moon.
In May 1961, President Kennedy laid out an ambitious goal to beat the Soviets to the moon. And he made one thing clear. America's colleges and universities would be at the center of that mission.
But we do not intend to stay behind, and in this decade, we shall make up and move ahead.
Kennedy told Congress, increasing the quality and availability of education is vital to both our national security and our domestic well-being. A free nation can rise no higher than the standard of excellence set in its schools and colleges.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
Even after Kennedy's assassination, his vision lived on. His successor, Lyndon B. Johnson, picked up the mantle. One landmark bill opened the door to college for millions, offering loans, scholarships, and grants on a scale that was unprecedented.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
And all of this investment in education helped propel the U.S. ahead in the space race.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
It's probably not an overstatement to say that the dramatic surge of federal investment in STEM education was essential to this success. Without the support for colleges and universities, the U.S. almost certainly would not have landed a man on the moon as early as 1969. For the reformers, it felt like the culmination of 50 years of work. But they weren't done yet. They wanted a cabinet-level position, a secretary of education who would report directly to the president. Enter Jimmy Carter.
What Carter wanted to do was what LBJ wanted to do, which is how do we use the power of the federal government to improve education, including federal funding?
For the individualist, this was the third rail. Federal funding was one thing, but federal control over higher education was another thing entirely.
One of the strongest foes was someone who had been a teacher. He's a Democrat. He's too all over the place to be called progressive or liberal, but it was Congressman Leo Ryan was one of the biggest foes of Carter's plan.
Congressman Ryan was a formidable opponent. In fact, after the bill passed the Senate, he managed to block it from reaching the House floor entirely. For a moment, it looked like the dream of a federal Department of Education might stay just that, a dream. But then, much like Sputnik had once broken the political deadlock, another strange twist of history reopened the door for reformers. Back in Congressman Ryan's district, a fanatical church called the People's Temple was raising alarms. Its members were reportedly building a remote settlement in Guyana called Jonestown, named for their charismatic and controlling leader, Jim Jones.
But sometimes I'll speak in parables, and when I speak in parables, inside I'll be choked up and my chest will feel tight, but when I say, I am, when I say,
Congressman Ryan led a delegation to see Jonestown firsthand. But as they tried to leave, he and several others were assassinated by followers of Jim Jones. Hours later, Jones orchestrated a mass suicide that claimed the lives of more than 900 people.
The nightmare at Jonestown left more than 900 members of the People's Temple dead. Americans who had followed the Reverend Jim Jones into the Guyanese jungle in search of a better life.
Suddenly, through no political genius on Carter's part, the road to a department becomes much easier because the biggest opponent was killed by a suicide cult.
On October 17, 1979, the modern Department of Education was established. Its mission was ambitious: to ensure access to high-quality education for every American, from kindergarten through college. At last, the reformers had achieved their goal. And they wasted no time, mobilizing the new department to fund and support education nationwide. But the individualists didn't disappear just because they'd lost. They stayed in the wings, waiting for the right moment to strike back.
DMV summers are no joke. The heat, the humidity, the beltway at 5 p.m. AC season is here and your car needs to keep up. Rota is the DMV's most trusted auto shop with over 1,000 five-star Google reviews. From AC checks to oil changes to detailing, we keep your car ready with no hidden fees and no pressure. Plus, free valet pickup and drop-off, so you don't have to lift a finger. Book at rota.com and save 20% on maintenance, repairs, or detailing with code POD20.
My guess is that the best move for the quality of life in America in the future might very well be this establishment of this new Department of Education, because it will open up for the first time.
In 1979, the Department of Education opened its doors after more than a century of debate and resistance. And almost immediately, it came under fire. In fact, Ronald Reagan, then a presidential candidate, called for its dismantling.
I would like to dissolve the $10 billion National Department of Education created by President Carter and turn schools back to the local school districts where we built the greatest public school system the world has ever seen. I think I can make a case that the decline in the quality of public education began when federal aid became federal interference.
But Reagan's plan ultimately fell apart, and for decades, his calls to dismantle the Department of Education stood as the last serious threat. While some lawmakers and think tanks continued to question its role, the department became deeply embedded in the fabric of American education. It took on major responsibilities, tracking school performance and graduation rates, shaping national education policy, and administering emergency relief during crises like COVID. But perhaps its most critical role has been managing federal student aid, the massive program that administers loans, grants, and scholarships to millions of students every year.
The Department of Education is one of the smallest agencies in government, but it does so much. The vast majority of the student loan market is owned by the Department of Education.
That's Bonnie Luttrell. She's an expert on higher education in America and has worked within the federal student aid program, known as FSA.
The work of FSA made my college experience and law school experience possible. I was a Pell Grant recipient. Pell Grants are handled by federal student aid. I came from low-income background, and Pell Grants made my attendance at a public college possible. And then when I went to law school, anyone who has even considered law school knows how expensive it is. I got a scholarship and I had some of it covered, but it was still going to be $150,000. My family was not sitting on $150,000. I had no other option.
Bonnie's story is just one of millions. More than half of college students depend on federal aid. And it's federal student aid that makes that possible. In fact, Bonnie points out that if you measured it by the amount of money it distributes, the Department of Education would rank as the fourth largest bank in the country.
What FSA does is it makes loans available at terms that are set by law, at an interest rate that's set by Congress. Everyone gets the same loan product. Everyone has access to the same safety net. You become disabled, you can get your loan discharged. If your school lies to you or defrauds you, you have built-in defenses. These protections that make the promise of the American dream accessible. It is the only way millions of people go to school, myself included.
Imperfect as it may be, the federal loan program has been a gateway to the American dream, and that access has been transformative. Again and again, when the government has invested in education, the results have been extraordinary. After Sputnik, federal funding for science education helped put a man on the moon. That kind of investment in education has continued to fuel breakthroughs across every field. Thanks to federal loans, leaders like Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz and countless others were able to pursue higher education. But just as important are the millions of everyday Americans, people whose names you'll never know, who built better lives because they had access to education. But for any of this to work, the Department of Education needs sustained effort and oversight. Which brings us back to Bonnie. Before joining the Department of Education, she worked at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, an agency that makes sure banks and lenders play by the rules.
I was an investigator in their complaints division, and I still remember this complaint and I think about it all the time. It was a borrower who had a private student loan.
This borrower had his grandmother co-sign his loans. The plan was simple. After 5 years of on-time payments, he could remove her from the loan and lift the burden off her shoulders.
This borrower did everything right. His payment history was perfect. He was so on top of it that he was overpaying each month. And so one month he gets this bill for $0, doesn't make a payment because how do you pay a $0 bill? And then he went to get his grandmother, his co-signer, released from his loan. And his lender denied it because they said, well, you missed a payment here.
The story stuck with Bonnie, so much so that she took a new job at the Department of Education, serving as the federal student aid ombudsman, a role focused on helping borrowers resolve disputes with their federal student loans. And for years, she loved the work. But as the 2024 election grew closer, a sense of unease began to creep in. Since the Reagan era, no president had made a real push to dismantle the Department of Education. The long-running battle between reformers and individualists had cooled, reduced to skirmishes over budgets, standardized testing, and local control. But Donald Trump's third campaign reignited the fight. And when he ultimately won, the individualists finally had the ally they'd been waiting for. Bonnie knew change was certainly coming. What she didn't know was just how fast or how far it would go.
I thought there's no chance in hell Trump wins. But they didn't get what they needed from the Biden administration. And, you know, hindsight's 2020. Trump won. And then at that point, the reaction, which was shared by many of my colleagues, was just, oh, fuck.
June is here, which means it's finally time to reach for your summer wardrobe. And if you're trying to look good without overheating, Quince is your best bet. Their summer collection has all the warm weather staples, breathable linen, washable silk, and soft organic cotton. I now own their 100% linen pants in more colors than I'd like to admit. And the best part is that you get all that quality without the luxury markup. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a destination for elevated essentials across the home, from kitchen to bedding, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/campus for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/campus for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/campus.
Baseball is back, and BetMGM, official partner of Major League Baseball, is bringing the heat all season long. step up to the plate all season with Swing for the Fences, the free-to-play game where every swing could score you rewards. We're talking parlay boost tokens, odds boost tokens, same-game parlay boost, and even bonus spins all season long. And the action doesn't stop there. Get more out of every at-bat with MLB same-game parlay boost. Stack your picks and boost your potential payout. Plus, lock in bigger value with MLB odds boost tokens and MLB parlay boost tokens all season long. More boosts, more swings, more chances to win. Download the BetMGM app and step up to the plate today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus and present in Ohio. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards payback and unrestricted withdrawable funds. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. In partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
In November 2024, Donald Trump was elected to the presidency for the second time on a platform that included eliminating the Department of Education.
And I'm going to close the Department of Education and move education back to the states. And we're going to do it fast.
Early November, I will say there was a lot of crying from people at the department. You know, he campaigned on shutting the department down. Everyone thought they were going to lose their jobs.
Suddenly, the department wasn't just under scrutiny, it was under siege. And for employees like Bonnie, the attacks became personal. Her name was added to a Department of Education watch list, compiled by a conservative nonprofit targeting federal staff.
This stupid list said it was something about, like, they considered it woke ideology. It was the most unflattering picture I've ever seen of myself.
Bonnie jokes about it now, but it's clear the temperature was rising and things were changing quickly.
The day after the Trump election results, career staff and leadership at the Education Department immediately began taking steps to slow walk the Biden agenda and start enacting what they expected the Trump agenda to be.
And part of that agenda immediately impacted Bonnie's ability to support borrowers.
For me, the writing was on the wall. The day after the election results, I saw the shift in a lot of the career leadership and how they were acting. And they made very clear to me that they viewed me as a problem. With my position as visible as it was, the longer I stayed, the more at risk I put my team. And I don't think it was fair to put my entire team in the line of fire. I'm not going to be the reason someone doesn't get a paycheck.
In February 2025, Bonnie made the difficult decision to step down from her role. And in the months since, she's watched from the outside as the ground beneath the department slowly began to shift. At first, it was subtle. The quiet removal of the prominent complaint button on the department's website, the one borrowers use to report loan issues. But the changes didn't stay small for long.
In case you missed it, the Department of Education announced that on May 5th, we will restart collections of student loans in default. There's no such thing as forgiveness, just shifting the payment burden from one party to another.
Secretary McMahon announced that the department would resume forced collections on student loans, targeting borrowers who'd been unable to pay for years. With less than a month's notice, more than 5 million people were suddenly at risk of losing their tax refunds or even their Social Security benefits. At the same time, many of the offices within the department that once worked to ensure fair treatment for borrowers were suddenly being shuttered.
We've seen the complete decimation of the offices designed to make sure borrowers were getting everything they're legally entitled to, which to me says you don't actually care about borrowers. You don't care about taxpayers. You don't care about your constituency.
More recently, the Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to begin firing roughly 1,300 employees from the Department of Education. But Congress created the department, and under the law, only Congress has the authority to shut it down. Critics argue that these mass firings effectively sidestep that process, hollowing out the agency without formally closing it. Still, the layoffs are moving forward, and they're already taking a toll on one of the department's most vital functions, the federal student loan program. As students prepare to start a new school year this fall, that program is severely weakened and likely to get weaker as more employees are let go. Some students and families may already be feeling the impact, but the deeper, longer-lasting consequences may not be fully seen for years to come.
Having an educated workforce is good for everyone. I want my nurse to have gone to nursing school. I want my doctor to have gone to med school. I want my accountant to have gotten their degree in accounting. And that doesn't happen without the Department of Education.
So much of American history has been defined by a fight over the role of the federal government. And perhaps nowhere has that fight been more intense than in education. Because here's the paradox. Americans overwhelmingly agree that education matters. We just can't seem to agree on who should be in charge of it. Here's Adam Lotz again.
I think it shows the ways education has always worked from Reconstruction all the way to the now to the Trump administration. Americans aren't divided about education in the biggest ways. Americans want good education for their kids. That's something that even in the most divided times, Civil War, in current administrations, Americans are always been united about that. But the fights about who's going to fund it, and then especially who's going to control that budget, have been really tough. And it takes things like these unpredictable happenings in history to allow the deadlock to jolt free.
Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast. This episode was written and reported by Ian Mont. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont, Elliot Adler, and me, Margot Gray. Our executive producers and story editors are Maddie Sprunkheiser and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Basil and Andy Jaskowitz. Special thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman, J.D. Crowley, Leah Reese-Dennis, Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, Hilary Schuff, Sean Cherry, Laura Berman, and Hilary Van Ornum. Original theme music by James Waterman and Davey Sumner. If you have tips or story ideas, write to us at campusfilespod@gmail.com.